Our next speaker is Marlo Reynolds. Marlo is the Executive Director of the Pembina Institute for Appropriate Development. He's worked with Pembina, which is a not-for-profit, by the way, since about 1999. He holds a PhD in Mechanical Engineering from the University of Alberta, a Bachelor's in Systems Design Engineering from the University of Waterloo, and a Master's in Management from McGill University. I know Marlo because I think he's probably one of the few experts I can actually say is an expert in life cycle analysis. It's a field that we should all have some appreciation for, and Marlo is one of those people I always reference if I need to find out about that particular subject and really understand what is the overall impact of anything that we do on the energy side. So with that, Marlo, thank you.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you, Mark, for inviting me to your conference today. I've actually just finishing a week of being on vacation, and I tend to get myself into the outdoors and try to remind myself just how small we are with respect to some of the natural systems and natural forces we're involved in. So this past week, I actually spent in Tofino on the west coast of Vancouver Island trying to learn how to surf. Thank you, Ian. And anyone who's, you know, spent that time of trying to getting bashed around in those waves just knows how much potential energy really exists in that ocean. And I'm not sure how many people have actually tried to surf or learn how to surf, but, you know, these waves tend to come in sets. You know, and you battle really hard and you work really hard to get outside into the outer circle of the waves. The first set of waves, the first circle is just a bunch of whitewash and a real pain to get through. And once you get past that outside, there's sets of waves that come in. And between these sets, there's a lull. There's this kind of this moment of quietness between these sets of waves. Well, on my fifth day, you know, trying to learn how to figure this surfing thing out, I was in one of these lulls, and I could see the next set coming. It was looking like a pretty significant set of waves. But I was able to kind of reflect on that week a bit and say, you know, what kind of progress have I made here? It's been kind of a frustrating week. And at the end of, you know, as we all do coming to the nearing the end of a vacation, we sort of start thinking about the next week, what's coming up, and, you know, the fact that you have to be in Jasper speaking at a conference, and on Monday you're in Kelowna, and Wednesday you're in Toronto. You start sort of thinking through these things. And in that quiet moment, I had a bit of an aha moment. Now, and I might tell you about that aha moment a little bit later here near the end of this presentation. But for now, I've been asked to talk about this question around energy, environment, the economy, and can we have it all? And to bring a nonprofit organization's perspective to that. And as Ian said in my introduction, I've actually worked with the organization since 1995. So I spent the past 10 years working with the Pembina Institute, which is a nonprofit organization, about 45 staff now, about 20 years old, the organization, based here in Alberta, offices in Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary, Drayton Valley, where we started, and in Ottawa. And the focus of the organization is really looking at this transition of sustainable energy. How do we move towards sustainable energy? How do we get off of our carbon-intensive, fossil fuel-based conventional energy systems to a longer-term, more sustainable future with respect to energy? And we do that work looking at four kind of core audiences that we're trying to drive some change forward. One is the corporate sector. So we do work both working with the corporate sector in terms of a fee-for-service basis, putting solutions forward, doing research on what alternative energy looks like, what options look like. We also play as an intervener on major energy projects, such as oil sands projects, where we are a stakeholder in a coalition of other nonprofit organizations, raising tough questions about the environmental performance and the social performance related to oil sands development. We also do work in public policy, focused on climate change, both at provincial and a national level, related to energy and the environment. We have a youth education program is our third area that we focus on, where we provide resources to teachers. Some of you might be familiar with greenlearning.ca, which is launched recently here in Alberta, providing basically resources integrated right into the curriculum of energy environmental tools and and resources for teachers. And our fourth area is we do a lot of work with communities. We're actually working with about 30 First Nations communities in Western and Northern Canada, looking at energy efficiency locally at the community level, local resources from a renewables perspective, and also options of optimizing off-grid diesel, off-grid natural gas, or sorry, natural gas tends to be on-grid, but different resources at the local level. In terms of this question about energy and environment and the economy, can we have it all? I'd like to kind of bring focus to three key areas. And three key areas where I think science and science writing really needs to bring a lot of attention to now moving forward, especially in this next 18 months to, you know, couple of years here. The first area is on climate change. And I say climate change without saying Kyoto. And it's really time now to get beyond Kyoto. We've made a national commitment to it. We have a lot of work to do around implementation and to make a robust plan to meet our international commitment within the Kyoto framework. But we really need to start switching the dialogue to a longer-term framework around climate change. And answering that question of what does stabilization of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, in the global atmosphere, look like? What is the appropriate concentration? And what are the potential risks and benefits of meeting a global target on concentration? A recent report released this past week from the European Union, written by Netherlands and written by a Swiss Federal Institute for Research, was looking at the European goal or target of no more than 2 degrees Celsius change in temperature, in terms of average global temperature. And the work that they did looking at what does it take then to actually stay within that 2 degrees through their modeling work led them to saying we've got to hit 400 to 450 parts per million. And if we get it within that 400 to 450 parts per million of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, we've got about a 50-50 chance of keeping it below 2 degrees Celsius of change. And then they started looking at, well, what would it take to actually accomplish curving down CO2 concentration down to 400 parts per million? Their conclusions there that emissions need to peak before 2015 globally and needs to be followed by about a 30% below 1990 levels, so a 30% global emissions below 1990 levels by 2050. So we kind of need to have this peak curve and then bring down if we're serious about stabilizing CO2. From a Canadian perspective, then, we really need to reflect on that and say, what's our role, what's our contribution to bending the curve on CO2 concentrations? For us to have it all, for the answer to really be yes, we can have energy, the economy, environment, we need to take very seriously our contribution to reducing CO2 emissions. And so I think the debate and the discussion in the scientific community and in the papers and the articles that we write really need to address this question and wrestle with this and help spark a real strong national debate and discussion around our role nationally and provincially in terms of curving down carbon dioxide. We have a unique opportunity this year in Canada. That's why I kind of push forward of this year being a very important year, given that we are hosting the International Conference or the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change annual meeting this year in Montreal in November and December. And so that meeting of the parties is going to be critical and an opportunity for us to show some real leadership on how we are going to contribute to this. The second focus area that I would push forward for us to be really thinking on is on oil sands. Not sure if you noticed, but the Sawridge Hotel has a small chain. There are other operations in Fort McMurray. So I'm not sure if internally they talk about it as the Beauty and the Beast or how they work it out. But, you know, if you want to get on a tour of the Sawridge Hotels, I'd encourage you to spend some time in Fort McMurray, and you'd earn some effort or earn your right to come back to their Sawridge Hotel here in Jasper and enjoy the beauty here. A lot of debate, discussion, papers have been written around the economics of oil sands, and rightfully so. I mean, with the scale and the pace of investment that's projected into the oil sands on the order of about $60 billion between now and 2012, of course we're focusing on that. I mean, I'd hesitate to say, but I'm quite convinced it's probably currently the fastest-paced industrial investment anywhere in the world right now, and I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong on that. I think our focus and our focus on debate and discussion needs to be on the pace of development of oil sands. As was pointed out earlier, you know, it's now the second largest proven reserve, second to Saudi Arabia, but we need to really wrestle with how fast do we want to develop this resource? And how do we develop this resource so that the answer can be yes to that question about having environment, energy, and the economy together? And one of the primary focus areas within the oil sands discussion really needs to be around cumulative effects. Cumulative effects gets kind of referred to as the sort of death by a thousand cuts. You know, each individual project might be okay on its own, but how does the system work together in either a positive way or in a degrading way from an environmental perspective or a social perspective? And so a lot more scientific debate and rigor needs to be brought to the cumulative effects around oil sands. And when I talk about the cumulative effects, I talk about from an air, land, water, and energy inputs perspective. From an air perspective, in Alberta, we made quite a significant progress over the last 10 years with respect to reducing sulfur dioxide emissions. But the projection for the next 10 years is pretty much going to undo all of the progress that we've made with the projections looking forward in terms of in oil sands. We could end up putting ourselves being responsible in Canada for about 20% of sulfur dioxide emissions by 2010, second only to Ontario, if we don't start addressing that early on and looking at some of these cumulative effects. From a nitrogen oxide perspective, nationally, the projections are we as in Alberta will be responsible for some 38% of national emissions, putting us as the number one emitter on NOx. From a carbon dioxide perspective, oil sands crude is about 3 to 5 times more CO2 intensive than conventional crude oil. So we have significant progress from a technology perspective to keep bringing down the CO2 intensity. From a land perspective, you know, each barrel of oil needs about 2 tons of sand. So either you're mining 2 tons of sand or accessing 2 tons of sand underground in some shape or form. There's significant land footprint required to actually make that possible, to access that resource. From a water perspective, we need about 2.5 to 4 barrels of water per barrel of oil. How do we bring that down? What are the cumulative impacts on, say, the Athabasca River? And then the big question about the energy inputs. How do we actually wash sand? You know, how do we heat enough water to wash the sand to get the bitumen or get the oil off that we want? Right now, we're using what's considered probably the cleanest and best fossil fuel out there of natural gas. You know, it is probably the most important transition fossil fuel that we have, and we're using it to wash sand. So what are the alternatives around providing the heat that we need? And what was mentioned earlier by Eddie is the deep geothermal. And there's a potential kind of silver lining out of this whole oil sands project of deep geothermal. And it'd be really interesting to see some more thorough writing and thorough analysis of what that potential looks like. In the next, the Pembina Institute will be releasing a detailed primer on oil sands in October, which will be a kind of a one-stop comprehensive guidebook of kind of giving an idea of the oil sands aspects. And then we'll also be posting a session and tours for journalists to kind of engage with the journalist community on the oil sands side. The third focus area is on Canadian energy strategy. We're one of the few, you know, industrialized countries in the world that does not have a clear documented national energy strategy. And I think there's a real important role for the scientific community to bring good discussion, good debate of pulling the pieces of energy efficiency, renewable energy, conventional sources, nuclear energy. How do all these pieces fit together in a national energy strategy? We really need to have that debate and discussion over the next 18 months to 24 months. And bringing together the science, technology, social behavior, and the environment. So I think the most influential papers and articles that will come from, that will emerge from authors that successfully bring together the environmental aspects, the social aspects, the technology, and the economic, and bundle that all into a compelling and powerful story. Now, to do that good scientific writing, we need some framework of measurement. What does success really look like? And we often lean towards the gross domestic product, GDP. Now, another story from when we were surfing, one person, there's a real strong rip currents in some of these. And later that afternoon on that fifth day, someone got basically pulled out to the ocean. That person was heading for Japan. And on the beach, we had to call and coordinate Coast Guard and guide their boat from the coast of where we could see this perfect person bobbing up and down every once in a while. And this person was way out. Well, I can guarantee when that person came back in, he was not very proud of having contributed to the GDP. Of having the cost associated with organizing and coordinating that rescue operation. Or think about the cost of every motor vehicle accident. How good do you feel about having contributed to the GDP? That is not an appropriate measure of success with respect to well-being. So I think we need to think much broader, much better about how we measure success and what we bring to that. And one of the frameworks is a genuine progress indicator. In the year 2000, the Pemmican Institute did the genuine progress indicator for Alberta. We're updating that this year for Centennial. The Calgary Herald is actually running an eight-part series over the course of the year on these pieces. And so I think it's an opportunity, I think it's a real leadership opportunity for Alberta to develop a comprehensive framework that has social, environmental, and economic aspects rolled right into a framework for measurement. So in closing, on this question on energy, environment, and the economy, can we have it all? I would concur with the other panelists of yes, we can. But we really need to be looking at pace of oil sands. How do we be able to answer that question and be able to develop oil sands? We need to have the political will to develop and show real leadership on an energy strategy for Canada. We need to take our global responsibility for climate change very seriously in terms of curbing absolute concentrations. And we need to measure our success better. And I think in that context, and if we take up that challenge, we can answer yes to that question. Thank you.